looking at the Haftarah of Parshas Vaera, and this is from the Navi Yecheskel. And again, although I've mentioned some of the history before, I need to always go over the history because it's a little complicated. Remember the following basic idea, and we're going to keep it very, very basic. The destruction of the Jewish state and the Gullus of Klal Yisrael at the time of the Churban Bayis Rishon occurred in three distinct stages. The first was the conquest of Eretz Yisrael by the Babylonian Empire. That was the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. And that occurred very early in Nebuchadnezzar's reign. That actually occurred in the second year of his reign. He ruled for 45 years. In the second year of his reign, he conquered Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael became a vassal state. There was still the Beis HaMikdash. There were still Jewish kings, but they were paying tribute to Babylonia. And that is where Daniel, or Daniel, as we should properly pronounce it, was taken. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they were taken to Babylonia to be vassals, to be servants, to be court advisors, as it would be trained rather to be court advisors, etc. Right? So that was the first stage. That is called the stage of Kibush. Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar. Oh, who was the king in Israel? The king was Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim happened to be the king. So this is called Kibush Jehoiakim in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. In the ninth year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, just 7 years later, the ninth year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, we have, because Jews were rebelling and the like, we have the first actual large-scale exile. And in that large-scale exile, this is in the ninth year of his reign, we have the exile of what is called the Charash and the Masker. Now, the Charash and the Masker literally means carpenters and locksmiths. So if you read the Pasuk literally, the carpenters and the locksmiths were taken to Babylonia. What does Nebuchadnezzar have against carpenters and locksmiths? Or maybe the other way around. Couldn't get a good locksmith in Babylonia. He had to import them. So the simple meaning, Pshuto Shel Mikra, is he wanted to empty the land of Israel of all people who were capable of making weapons. So essentially, it was a way of removing people who knew how to fashion metal and tools and the like. However, Chazal have a different interpretation. Chazal's interpretation of the Charash and the Masker are the learned aristocratic classes of Talmidei Chachamim. And how do you get that from Charash and Masker? Because Charash comes from the word mute. And that is, these people were so great in Torah that whenever they spoke, everybody else was mute. You had nothing to add. And Masker is the same idea, Soger. When they gave their opinion on a halacha, Soger, the matter was closed. Now, in that first wave of Golos, the king then was Jehoiachin, who happened to be Jehoiakim's son. And that stage is called Golos Jehoiachin, right? And that was in the ninth year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And Jehoiachin, if you just reverse the letters a little bit, is also called Yechaniah. And among the famous people who were exiled then was none other than Mordechai, right? That's what that's the pasuk in Megillas Esther that we read with the tune of Eicha. Asher Hegla, we had singing today, I'm not going to, I know you had singing earlier, but it says, Asher Hegla Yerushalayim, that he was exiled from Jerusalem, Im HaGola Asher HaGlasa, with the exiles that were exiled, Im Yechaniya Melech Yehuda. This was in the ninth year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, the Golos of the Charash and the Masker. Yecheskel, our Navi Yecheskel, was also one of those Gedolim who was exiled to Bavel with the Charash and the Masker, as opposed to Yirmiyahu, who stayed in Eretz Yisrael. And the basic idea is that why Nebuchadnezzar did it, it's hard to figure out exactly. Why did Nebuchadnezzar single out Talmidei Chachamim? Perhaps he felt that without the Zechus of Torah in Eretz Yisrael, they would not be able to rebel. But why Hashgacha singled it out is very, very clear, and that is that a whole infrastructure of Torah learning should already be set so that when the rest of the Jewish population comes to Babylonia, all the yeshivos will be there. This is called the Golos of the Chorosh and the Mazgir. So again, Kibush was year two. The Golos of the Chorosh and the Mazgir was in year nine. 11 years later, because the Jews that remained continued to revolt. And remember, Yirmiyahu HaNavi kept on telling the Jewish people, do not revolt against the Babylonians, Hashem is not going to help you, don't do it. And Yirmiyahu HaNavi was accused of being an appeaser, a quizzling, to use the World War II reference, and the like. And Yirmiyahu was, in fact, there were many false prophets who said in the name of God, fight against the Babylonians and God will be with you. And Yirmiyahu said, halvai, you would be correct. I pray that I'm wrong and you're right. But that's not going to be so. And 11 years later, which was, again, in the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, on the 9th of Av, was the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and the exile. Now, even then, some Jews were allowed to stay in Eretz Yisrael, a small number, under the leadership of Gedaliah. And then the following Tishrei, Gedaliah got killed, and that was really the end. So there actually is a little bit of a story even after the Chorban. Okay, so it's important. I don't want to overwhelm you with dates and years and everything else, but at a minimum, we should know these three steps in the destruction of the Jewish presence in Eretz Yisrael. The conquest, all of this is during Nebuchadnezzar's reign. The conquest in year two, the Golos of the Chorosh and the Mazgir in year nine, and the Chorban Beis HaMikdash in year 19, 11 years later. And there were three different Jewish kings at that time. The king at the time of the conquest was Jehoiakim. The king at the time of the exile of the Chorosh and the Mazgir was Jehoiakim's son, Jehoiachin, or Yechaniah. And the final king, who was the king at the time of the Chorban, is Jehoiachin's uncle, which is Jehoiakim's brother, and that is Tzidkiyahu. Tzidkiyahu was the last king of Malchus Beis David, and if you remember, he was given a prophecy by Yirmiyahu that if you rebel against Babylonia, you shall be brought to Bavel and you will die in Bavel and your eyes shall not see Bavel. And he didn't understand what that prophecy meant, but you know what Chazal teach us. Right near Shar Shechem in the old city, you have the Ma'aras Tzidkiyahu. And you know the Medrash of Chazal that Tzidkiyahu tried to escape the city as Nebuchadnezzar was closing in. And he was apprehended because Shmuel made a miracle that although he would have escaped, but there was a deer that Nebuchadnezzar was chasing. And the deer was going in exactly the direction of Tzidkiyahu's subterranean voyage. And as he emerged from the cave of Ma'aras Tzidkiyahu, Nebuchadnezzar apprehended him. And he slaughtered all of his children in front of his eyes, so that would be the last thing he would remember. He then pierced out his eyes. He was then brought to Bavel and executed. And indeed, the words of the Navi were fulfilled. You shall be brought to Bavel, you shall die in Bavel, and your eyes shall never see Bavel. And this was a literal fulfillment. Tzidkiyahu himself was actually a tzaddik, as the name suggests. He was actually a righteous man. But basically, it was the Chorban, the generation was not worthy, and all of these tragedies occurred. Okay, so once again, I emphasize this almost every week, but just we have to remember this. Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel are contemporaries. Yechezkel is in Babylonia during the 11-year period. Yirmiyahu is in Eretz Yisrael. Yirmiyahu experiences the Chorban. Yechezkel is prophesying about the Chorban that will happen. He is part of the Chorosh and the Mazgir. Now, if you keep these basic dates in mind, you'll understand some interesting references in Yechezkel's prophecy. Yechezkel's prophecy which Chazal chose as the Haftorah of Vaera, is about the downfall of Egypt. Now the question is, why is Yechezkel prophesying about the downfall of Egypt? Didn't Egypt already fall, as it were, in the time of the Torah when the Jews left Mitzrayim? Well, the answer is no. Egypt was obviously decimated and destroyed through the Ten Makos and the Kriyas Yamsuf. But in the course of history, they once again became a great and powerful empire. And what is strange is, not only did they become a great and powerful empire, but they became an empire where the Jewish nation at various times sought the assistance of Egypt against other enemies that they thought were worse. First of all, already in the time of Shlomo HaMelech, we see exactly that. Remember, the Torah says, a king shall not have a lot of horses, lest he return the people to Mitzrayim. And Shlomo HaMelech, who thought he said he was so smart, says, I can have a lot of horses, and that's not going to happen. And of course, what happens is, he sends people to Mitzrayim. He marries Baspara, which was a royal alliance. Right? So Egypt, by now, became a very powerful empire. And not only did it become a powerful empire, but as Malchus Yehuda, remember the 10 tribes are already long gone. All you have is the kingdom of Yehuda around Yerushalayim, which is just Yehuda and Binyamin. And most of that kingdom is gone as well. Sancheriv of Assyria destroyed most of that kingdom. All you have is like Yerushalayim and, you know, maybe going to Beit Shemesh. You know, a very small, small area. You're going from Hebron to Beit Shemesh and the like. And they're confronted with the awesome might of the Babylonian Empire, which had already toppled Assyria in Nebuchadnezzar's first year before he conquered Eretz Yisrael. He's giving Assyria Eretz Yisrael. So they turn to Egypt for protection. Right? It's kind of anomalous. You know, sometimes you see advertisements for tours to Egypt. See it around here. And I even saw a Pesach tour to Egypt. It's just hard to understand exactly what that is. Unless after the Seder, you know, well, actually, there's a certain logic to it. You know, maybe if you go right by the border, we'll have our Seder Pesach night, and in the morning, we'll all cross over the border. Maybe there's something, you know, something to that, actually. But anyway, if you can do it that way. But anyway, Kriyas Yamsuf might be a little difficult to arrange on short notice. But anyway, so they turned to Egypt for help. And this was considered to be a great, great aveira, the notion of turning to Mitzrayim for assistance. Number one, Mitzrayim was obviously an immoral culture, a culture of Gilui Arayos, right? In fact, when the Torah itself tells us to be careful in Arayos, it emphasizes, don't be like Masa Eretz Mitzrayim. They were worse than the Canaanites, although Canaanites are singled out as well. They were an immoral nation. They were a nation of idolatry. And when the Jews had the attitude that the foreign powers will protect us from aggression, that displays a lack of emunah in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's funny, people look for everything but Shuvah. You know, Shuvah is hard, right? So, in other words, you're faced with this enemy, and the Navi tells you what you have to do. Turn to Hashem, do tshuva, avas Yisrael. But we don't want to do that. So let's go with this alliance, and this alliance, and this alliance, and this alliance, and they'll help us, and they'll help us, and they'll help us. Well, ultimately, not only is that an aveira because it shows a lack of emunah, but it also means that you look for distractions not to do tshuva. And therefore, when you read the Nevi'im, one of the themes that come across in every Navi prior to the Churban is the sin of forming these foreign alliances with idolatrous, perverse cultures. And in the Haftarah of Parshas Vaera, Yechezkel does not talk about the sin of the Jewish people, at least in this chapter, but he talks about the fact that the Jewish people will see that Mitzrayim can help them, cannot help them at all. Because not only, see in a double way, not only will Mitzrayim not be able to protect them from Nebuchadnezzar, but Mitzrayim, the great powerful Mitzrayim, shall fall to Nebuchadnezzar, although it falls later. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar did not conquer Egypt till after he conquered Eretz Yisrael. But Yechezkel is foreseeing the downfall and destruction of Egypt at that time. Yeah.
Why? Yechezkel is in Babel. Why is he given to people this prophecy? We think that this prophecy would be important to the Jews in Israel.
Yeah.
Looking for the alliances. Why is he giving it to the Jews in
Israel? Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question, exactly. I mean, Yechezkel is constantly, I mean, his nevuahs are primarily to the Jews in Eretz Israel, and the question is, why did Hashem choose him? It's hard to know. The truth is, Yirmiyahu has anti-Mitzrayim prophecies as well. It's not only Yechezkel. In fact, next week's Haftorah will be a very similar prophecy, and that'll be delivered through the mouth of Yirmiyahu. But as a general principle, just as a very, very general principle, the meaning of Yechezkel as Navi in Bavel is Hashem wants to communicate to the Jewish people that even though you're going to lose your land, even though you're going to lose your Beis HaMikdash, the Shekhinah will be with you even when you are out of the land. And that was a very, very important nechama for people to internalize, which means, in other words, even in the negative prophecies of Yechezkel, the very fact that he is able to deliver these prophecies from Galus is a powerful, important message. That is why the first chapter of Yechezkel, which is very, very mystical, we're not supposed to ponder it so much, is the Maise Merkava. It describes the divine chariots of Hashem, the Kisei HaKavod of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I know in the art scroll Yechezkel, written by Rav Moshe Eisman, a Rebbe in Eretz Yisrael, it's like a pack of cigarettes. Every page has a surgeon's general warning. Do not delve into this. Do not delve into this. And the like. But one of, and of course, obviously I'm not going to delve into it, but one of the central meanings of Merkava, means a chariot, is movement. Movement. The notion that Hashem is with you wherever you go. Well, that's very correct. Yoshio, who was the father of Yehoyakim and Sidkio. Yoshio was actually killed by Paro. Well, it just shows you how desperate the Jewish people were. I mean, basically, they'll do anything but do tshuva. That's the one thing they don't want to do. And that is, essentially, they're like, they're like rats on a sinking ship. I mean, basically, the principle is, this Babylonian monster is coming to devour them. They figure, let's make some short-term alliance with Egypt that will protect us. Of course, keep in mind, I mean, this is the funny thing. I mean, this is Lahavda. I mean, this is like the, I mean, let's assume the alliance with Egypt would have been successful and Babylonia would have been defeated. Well, what is Egypt then going to do? I mean, it's very, very... Yeah, it's very short-sighted anyway, because in all likelihood, Egypt would have devoured them. In other words, you're not really gaining anything by having Egypt help you against Babylonia. They'll just swallow you up. It's like, you know, the Hitler-Stalin alliances and everything else. Okay. So basically, this is a nevuah about the downfall of Mitzrayim, and its connection to the Torah Parsha is very, very apparent. The Torah Parsha talks about how God will take a nation, the nation of Egypt, that did not believe in God. Paro says very scornfully, I mean, you can see the sarcasm in the very words, who is this God that Moshe Rabbeinu says, Hashem HaKadosh Baruch Hu commands you to send forth his people. And Paro looks at his pantheon, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not in his list of idols, and he says, who is this God that I should listen to him? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu proceeds to show him who is this God with 10 makos, breaking their might. Of course, it continues into next week, which is why next week's Haftorah is a continuation of the same theme. Well, here we have the same idea of the arrogance of Egypt and the lack of emunah of Klal Yisrael in not remembering the makos and in turning to Mitzrayim once again. And he uses some very colorful language. He talks about Pyro's attitude. If you look at Pasuk Gimel in Yechezkel, Daber v'yomarta ko amar Hashem Elokim, so says God, Hineni Alecha Pyro Melech Mitzrayim, behold, I am turning myself against you, Pyro, the king of Egypt. Hatanin Tanim Hagadol, the great serpents. Remember the beginning of Bereishis, it talks about God created the Taninim Hagadolim, Some say that's the Leviathan and the Leviathan's mate. Others just say it's some gigantic creature, maybe the blue whale. Again, the exact translations of these animals are not always clear, other than they are fearsome and giant. Some even say they're just big alligators, which are not necessarily giant. I'm sorry, not alligators, crocodiles. Alligators are only in America, but the Egyptian one is. By the way, the Abarbanel says, that the plague of Sephardim, of frogs, he translates it as crocodiles, which makes it a little more fearsome, I guess. But that's his interpretation of being overrun with crocodiles, huh? Yeah, right. Anyway, so he describes Paro as a great fearsome crocodile who dwells in the Nile. And he says, this is a famous biblical expression of arrogance, Li Ya'ori, the river belongs to me, V'ani Asisini, and I am the one who made it. Again, one has to know, and of course we know this from the Chumash, we know this from history, and even today, just to a large degree, how dependent Egypt's prosperity was, certainly in the ancient world, on the Nile River. That without the Nile, there was nothing. And Paro, in his arrogance, the prophet portrays, Paro declared himself a god. Paro, through some delusion of grandeur, said, I made this Nile. Now again, this could either be understood as a delusion. He literally thought he was the creator. Or basically, even in terms of the arrogance of a ruler, he basically says, the prosperity of my country is because of me. I made the canals. In other words, even if you don't assume the supernatural delusion, I made the canals, I made the policies. Well, even that was wrong, because the agricultural policy of Egypt was actually established by Yosef all the way back in the Torah itself. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, through Mida Keneged Mida, likes to use a person's very delusion to be the source of his downfall. You, Paro, analogize yourself to the crocodile that owns the water, right? The crocodile kind of just sits in the water, doesn't even have to move. He's the boss. Nobody dares approach the crocodile. So God says, I will take a hook and drag this crocodile out of the water with the hook. And all the little fishes, all the little fish, your subordinate subjects, will be stuck to your scales, like sometimes little animals are stuck to a big animal and the light. And when I pull you out, they're all going to be pulled out with you. And you will be given into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylonia. And the Jewish people will realize that you were nothing. In fact, the analogy is very picturesque. You were nothing but a weak reed. They leaned on you for help. But you will be a reed that will snap. And then it goes further. If you imagine, let's say you're leaning on a reed, right? The reed is going to snap. But not only is it going to snap, but when it breaks, it'll have all sorts of pointy ends that are going to cut into your shoulder. So he says that the Jewish people will discover that Egypt is a broken reed that will cut into their shoulders. And they're going to have to adjust their balance, get back on their legs. And legs, of course, are a remez to Torah and mitzvos, which really support us. Meaning, to lean on Mitzrayim is koneh ratzutz, a broken reed. You have to get on your masnayim. Your masnayim are your thighs, your legs. And the masnayim are always considered to be a remez to the Torah and the mitzvos that give us strength and give us support. So this is a nevuah. Now, what it says is the following, though. The nevuah tells us that this will happen the 27th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Now, this date is recorded in the Navi himself, that the Mapala of Mitzrayim. Well, in other words, there are two things here. That Mitzrayim didn't help the Jews, that occurred earlier. Because remember, the Chorban Beis HaMikdash was the 19th year in Nebuchadnezzar's reign. So Mitzrayim turned out to be a dud. But it still took Nebuchadnezzar a number of years till he actually conquered and subjugated Mitzrayim. So remember, Chorban Beis HaMikdash, year 19, the actual Mapala of Mitzrayim will be in year 27 of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And then there's an interesting aspect that Yechezkel adds to this prophecy, and he says that when Mitzrayim will be vanquished, it will be turned into a desolate, empty, forsaken area in which no man nor beast will tread for a period of 40 years. It's very interesting. There's a lot of analogous language to what the Jewish people went through. And after the 40 years, they will come back to their land, but they will be a lowly, insignificant kingdom that will no longer play a role in world history, at least as a mighty kingdom. They will be what is called a Malchus Shefala, a lowly land, which is very true, because, you know, even when you talk about, you know, Cleopatra and everything else, I mean, it was not an Egyptian empire that had any power. I mean, when you had the Ptolemaic dynasty, they were Greek. They were not Egyptian. The Egyptians as Egyptians were smashed. Now, the question becomes, we understand why Nebuchadnezzar was given the koach to destroy Egypt, because the Jewish people turned to Egypt, which was an idolatrous, immoral culture. But where do you get this 40 years of desolation? It's a bit of a mystery. That for 40 years there will be desolation, and then the Egyptians will come back and be able to establish a government, a state, a country, a nation, but it will be insignificant and powerless. So Rashi brings a fascinating medrash, a very enigmatic medrash in a way. Rashi says that it was initially decreed all the way back from Yosef that Mitzrayim would go through 42 years of famine and starvation. Where on earth do you get 42 years of famine and starvation? Well, Paro had two dreams. Paro had a dream of the seven lean cows swallowing the seven fat cows. And Paro also had a dream of the seven lean, wind-dried sheaves swallowing the fertile sheaves. Now, even though Yosef interpreted that to mean 7 years of famine, right? Plenty followed by famine, and the repetition just means it's going to happen. Yosef was actually wrong. That's what the Medrash says. Actually, HaKadosh Baruch Hu in those two dreams meant there would be 14 years of famine. However, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as it were, was mevatel his shdas because of Yosef's interpretation. Now, so it turns out that the two dreams equals 14 years of famine. Yep. Now, when Paro told over the dream to Yosef, those two dreams, apparently the telling over of the dream would create a new gezeirah of another 14 years. 14 years in Paro's dream, 14 years in Paro recounting the dream, and then when Yosef said over the dream, another 14 years. 14 times 3, 42 years. Now, Yosef himself interpreted the dream. This is a Medrash. This is not even the Rishonim. This is the Medrash itself. Yosef said there would be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. But we do know from the Chumash itself that Yaakov Avinu came to Mitzrayim after the second year of famine. Right, and Yosef did say there are 5 more years of famine, but Chazal say, Rashi says, that from the time Yaakov came to Eretz Yisrael, 5 years were canceled. It became years of plenty. So it turns out of the 42 years of famine that were decreed on the land of Mitzrayim, only 2 years were experienced. So Mitzrayim has a 40-year debt based on the Gezeirah of Hashem. So it's one thing for Hashem to say, hey, I'll cancel the famine because of Yaakov Avinu, but don't think you Egyptians are going to get the benefit of that. It's going to come back. And Rashi brings the Medrash that Taka says that the Gezeira of the 40 years of desolation correspond to the 40 years of famine that were never paid going back from that original time. That's a very, very amazing Medrash. I mean, it's an amazing Medrash in a lot of different ways. I mean, it's amazing because it seems to indicate that Yosef was totally incorrect. In other words, Yosef said 7 years of famine, which didn't happen anyway, but really it was supposed to be 42 years of famine. Of course, by analogy, that would also mean 42 years of plenty. So, I mean, that also would have to be built in. Of course, that creates all sorts of complications in terms of Hashem's chronology for Yetzias Mitzrayim. That would have thrown it off as well. But nevertheless, you see, right, there's a statement in the Gemara that says, dreams follow the interpreter, which means in many, many ways, the interpreter of a dream creates the reality of that dream. The Gemara even has a story about Abaye of Arava. It's a strange story. Gemara in Brachos, quite a few stories, a few pages about this, where there was a great dream interpreter in Babylonia called Bar Hedja. It's not even clear if he was Jewish. And Abaye paid him for dream interpretation and Rava didn't pay him. And the Gemara gives a bunch of stories. They both had the same dreams. And the one who paid him got good interpretations and the one who didn't pay him got bad interpretations. And bad things kept on happening to Rava, and, you know, because he didn't want to pay for dream interpretations. There is a concept that a chalom is based on the interpreter. Okay. Now, there is then but again, it's very amazing that after the 40 years, I mean, if you look at Pasuk Yudalit, it's such a strange verbalization. It says, after the 40 years, very, very odd, Akabetz etz Mitzrayim min ha'amim asher nafotsu shama. I will gather the Egyptians from all the nations to which they were scattered. I mean, this is the identical lashon that Nevi'im always use, l'kabeitz nitche Yisrael. I will gather the Egyptians. And it even says, v'shafti yeshivus Mitzrayim. I will restore the captivity of Egypt. V'hashivos yosam. And I will return them to Eretz Patzros. Again, that's the land of the pharaohs, etc. I mean, it's a comforting type of language. But it does end, v'hayusham mamlacha shefala. But it shall be a lowly, inferior nation. Min hamamlachos tiyeh shefala. It shall be lowest among nations. V'lo tisnasei od ala goyim. It will never be able to have ascendancy over other nations. V'himatim. I will make them ma'at, meaning I will make them weak. Levilti ridos. They will not rule over nations. V'lo yiyah od lebeishel miftach, and they will no longer be an imaginary source of security for Bnei Yisrael, etc. And they will know that it is only Hashem that is your source of salvation. Okay, but again, it's very, very odd that there's kind of, I mean, of course, Hashem says there'll be mamlacha shvala, but he utilizes the almost the terms of endearment that are used for the return of Am Yisrael. Now, there's one other oddity just in terms of the Haftorah itself, and it says, it talks about Nebuchadnezzar conquering Mitzrayim. It also talks about Nebuchadnezzar conquering Tzor. Now, Tzor is Tyre, right? Tzor was a major, major city on the Mediterranean coast in Lebanon, in Phoenicia. Very, very wealthy city. And it mentions how Nebuchadnezzar conquered Tzor, which had enormous commercial wealth. But then it says there will be no reward for all of his efforts. And why is there no reward? There's plenty to get in Tzor. So there's actually a medrash that supplements the narrative by saying that after he conquered Tzor, there was a huge tidal wave, a tsunami of sorts, that swept everything away. And therefore, on one hand, Nebuchadnezzar did accomplish Hashem's shlichus of destroying Tzor, but he got nothing from it. But Mitzrayim was a different story. He did get the wealth of Mitzrayim. Now, it mentions the following. It mentions, on that day, Bayomahu, this is the last pasuk of the Haftarah, Bayomahu, Atzmiach keren lebeis Yisrael. I will cause a horn to grow. Right now, we know this is an expression, an expression that appears in Tanakh very often, and it appears in our davening as well, taken from Tanakh. We talk about Semach David, the horn, right? Horn, just like in the case of an animal, a horn is a source of strength and power and defeating your enemies. So when we talk about God giving us might and God giving us salvation, we talk about God giving us the horn of Yeshua. And on that day, I will give you the horn of salvation. So here's the question. You know, we read these psukim and we often get swept up in the rhetoric. But Rashi raises a very simple question. This chapter of Nach is talking about the destruction of Egypt by Nebuchadnezzar. The destruction of Egypt by Nebuchadnezzar did not result in any salvation for the Jewish people. Again, let's remember the chronology. Year 19 of Nebuchadnezzar, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Year 27 of Nebuchadnezzar, Egypt, which is what? Which is 8 years after the Churban? Egypt was conquered and destroyed. Well, that didn't help the Jewish people in any direct sense. We're still in Golus Babel. It's 8 years. What happened 8 years after the Churban Beis HaMikdash that is called Matzmiach Keren Yeshua? Right? We sometimes don't think about this. We just read these psukim. We think Bayom Ahu is referring to Mashiach and the, you know, it's not. Bayom Ahu is saying the day that Egypt shall fall will be a Keren Yeshua for Am Yisrael. So Rashi and all the Mefarshim ask the question: what's the Keren Yeshua? It's 8 years after the Churban Beis HaMikdash. We're in the middle of our Babylonian exile. Good, it's going to end after 70 years, but it's only after ages, it's not by Yom Ahu. So there are a lot of different interpretations. This is actually a pasuk in which all the Mefarshim have different approaches. Let me just share with you briefly some approaches. Some approaches say, you know, sometimes the biggest, most important salvation in life is not necessarily getting your land and getting your freedom, but to understand that Hashem runs the world. Yeah, you're still in Golus, but to see that the mighty Egyptian empire in whom you put all of your trust gets defeated is a great internal spiritual salvation, because it makes a Jew realize Ein lanu lehishayeh, there's no one that we can rely upon Ela al avinu shebashamayim, our Father in heaven. So in that sense, it's a little less dramatic. The Atzmiach, and of course it's a little atypical as well, the Atzmiach Keren Yeshua is not referring to any salvation of the Jewish people, but they have acquired a certain lesson in Emunah which will later be the basis of their salvation, and that is seeing the downfall of Mitzrayim was a very important lessonOkay, well, that's correct. The fact that their mom, yeah, the question, the suggestion was made that maybe by destroying Mitzrayim, that disabled a future threat against the Jewish people. That could be as well. But let me tell you how Rashi understands it. Rashi gives a second pshat, and then I'll tell you the Malbim. Rashi's pshat is that by Yom Ahu, and here I'm going to have to give you a little more arithmetical calculation, by Yom Ahu does not refer to the fall of Egypt, but it refers to what will happen after the 40 years. Now here I have to take my chronology a little further. Nebuchadnezzar ruled a total of 45 years, as I indicated. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in year 19. Right, the other years I don't have to go over right now. Mitzrayim was conquered year 27. Mitzrayim remained desolate and insignificant for 40 years. Now, 40 years takes us, as it were, well, it would be the 67th rule of Nebuchadnezzar, but that's not true. Nebuchadnezzar ruled 45 years. Nebuchadnezzar was succeeded by his son, Evil Merodach, who ruled for 23 years. So that gets you to 45 and 23. 45 of Nebuchadnezzar and 23 is 68. Now, if you calculate the 40 years from Mitzrayim, which was the 27th year, 40 years, this will take you to all the way to the end of Avil Merodach in the reign of Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, who was also considered Vashti's father, and that is Belshazzar. Now, in the book of Daniel, we read that in the first year of Belshazzar's reign, Daniel had visions through different animals and the like, that the Persian Empire shall conquer the Babylonian Empire. It didn't quite happen yet. It didn't happen until the third year of Belshazzar's reign. I'll go over that in a moment. But the dream that Daniel had about the downfall of Babylonia through the hands of the Persians did occur in the first year of Belshazzar, which is right after the 40 years of the decimation of Egypt. And we know that the Persians are called Keren Yeshua because it was Cyrus, the king of Persia, who gave permission for the Jewish people to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, that is called, by Yom Ahu, Rashi says, on the day that the 40 years are over, which will take us to the first year of Belshazzar, I will begin the process through the visions of Daniel that will culminate in the downfall. Now, let me just point out a little bit that it's very dramatic. Daniel had his visions in the first year of Belshazzar, but nothing happened in particular, which is why Rashi is a little difficult. We normally don't describe Matzmiach Keren Yeshua by a dream that a Navi had. In the third year of Belshazzar, which is two years later, we have the very famous scene in the book of Daniel. We discussed it earlier in the year, where Belshazzar took the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash and he made a party, a riotous party. And then the mysterious finger came and the handwriting on the wall. And the handwriting was in Ksav Ashuris, the writing of a Sefer Torah. Minei, minei, takalu parsin. Your days and your empire has been counted and weighed, and it will be divided and given to the Persians. And that very night, Belshazzar was killed by his own servants. And in a bloodless coup, other than his blood, but in a relatively bloodless coup, Dariush the First succeeded to the Babylonian Empire. And that was a very short reign. He was succeeded by Cyrus, by Koresh, who was then succeeded by Achashverosh of the Purim story, who was then succeeded by the son of Esther, Darius II, who actually completed the Beis HaMikdash. But Cyrus himself gave permission to return. So Rashi learns, by Yom Ahu, does not mean the downfall of Egypt, but it means the end of the 40 years, which takes us to the first year of Belshazzar's reign.
The pasuk says, by Yom Ahu, as we have care on the Beis Israel,
yeah.
Now, Keren can mean or, and Keren is the trumpet that announces.
Yes.
So if you use that interpretation, either Keren or Keren to announce, in other words, that this is the Keren is a harbinger.
So you're defending Rashi's. In other words, that would justify the idea that Daniel's Nevuah itself would be the announcement.
The announcement, in other words, Karen can be, because of the different interpretations.
Right, right. That's a good point. That it could be that Rashi understands Karen as the announcer, as opposed to the actual Geulah. And by the way, that's very good. By the way, the reference to the Persians as being the Keren Yeshua is not so far-fetched, because Yeshayo actually refers to Koresh, and this is way before Koresh, but the Nevuah, he refers to Koresh as Mashiach Hashem, the Anointed One of God. I think I mentioned before, Harry Truman loved, at some point, when he recognized the State of Israel, So somebody told him, you are like Cyrus, who is allowing the Jews to return to their ancestral land. And he was very taken with that. He loved the idea that he was Cyrus. So for the rest of his life, whenever he was honored at a Jewish banquet, and they would talk about how Truman, you know, recognized the state of Israel, even though the State Department was against it, and they were Arabists, as they are even today, and the like. So Truman would always pull the coat and say, you didn't say Cyrus, you didn't say Cyrus. And I'm sure to say Cyrus, you know. So I think even Ravon Cutler may have told him that he was Cyrus. He actually heard it from great people, that this was his role in history, to allow the Jewish people to return back to their homeland. Right? So that's Rashi's pshat, that Bayom Ahu refers to the first year of Belshazzar, and it refers to Daniel. The third pshat is the Malbim. And the Malbim has a very interesting thing. The Malbim, again, this is really speculation. I don't think he has a proof for this. But he says, let's go back to the simple meaning. Bayom Ahu, the day Egypt will be conquered by Babylonia, that will be a keren, a horn for Beis Yisrael. So Rashi raises the question, well, gee, the Jewish people, the Chorban was year 19 of Nebuchadnezzar, and Mitzrayim was conquered in year 27. What's the keren Yeshua? Right, that was Rashi's question. So the Malbim says the following. The Malbim says that we don't find any other conquest of Nebuchadnezzar after Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim was the end. Mitzrayim was Nebuchadnezzar's last conquest. Okay, that's reasonable. What then happened? So again, if you look in the book of Daniel, now, what's the problem is he doesn't give us a date there. But in the book of Daniel, it talks about Nebuchadnezzar built a gigantic statue. In fact, that itself corresponds to the four Malchias of gold and silver and copper and clay. And Nebuchadnezzar commanded that everybody bow down to that statue and worship it. Interestingly enough, Daniel seems to have been out of town for that one, which is interesting. Maybe after the lion's den, he figured he wouldn't be around for Nebuchadnezzar's whims. But there were three other tzaddikim who refused to bow down to that statue. And they were, of course, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. And they were thrown into a fiery furnace. And miraculously, they emerged intact. The Malbim speculation, I don't think he has a solid proof, was this was in the aftermath of Nebuchadnezzar's conquest of Mitzrayim, that was the biggest trophy in his conquest. And the Keren Yeshua is that the Jewish people should see this great miracle that those who believe in Hashem will not be consumed, even by the worst fire. So the Keren of Yeshua is the miracle of Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Now again, as I say, I don't think the Malbim has any direct proof, but he posits that maybe it's reasonable that after Nebuchadnezzar completed the conquest of Egypt, that's when he made this great monument to himself, and that would be the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Daniel was not there. It's interesting, Daniel was not involved in that particular miracle. Daniel was involved in the miracle of being thrown into the lion's den and was saved from that. Yeah.
First of all, Daniel would have been a very old man by then. Because Daniel was brought as a young man.
Yes.
First, some of the commentators say that Nebuchadnezzar purposely brought the brightest and the highest shechva in order to be able to rule over the satraps, in other words, to educate them in the ways of Babel, and then he could be maybe able to bring them back, or else have them as advisors.
Yeah.
For and as far as it's right, that was the known world then. Greece had not
right.
arisen yet as mm-hmm. power.
Right.
So Nebuchadnezzar, when he conquered Mitzrayim,
he completed that circle, that crescent.
Circle
yeah.
The
yeah.
So building the statue would be
right. No, but I just want to say that according to the Malbim, Daniel would not be particularly old, because I'll tell you why. I mean, Daniel was brought in the Eretz Yisrael, the initial kibush, which was the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Yeah, the second year. Now, this is the 27th year. Right, the downfall. So according to the Malbim, it would just be 25 years later. Now, where Daniel is real old, you're correct, is according to Chazal, Hasach, who is one of Achashverosh's attendants, is, according to some opinions, Daniel. That would put him more than 70 years after he came. But in the Malbim's event of the Tselem, Daniel would only be 25 years older than he was, whatever his age was at the time. Yeah.
But could it be that because Yishmael did Shuvah, Mitzrayim is Yishmael, maybe that's why the Tanakh
well,
about Yishmael.
No, I hear what you're saying, but I just want to remind you that ancient Mitzrayim was not Yishmael. Ancient Mitzrayim is not an Arabic nation. Mitzrayim is one of the children of Ham. Okay, Yishmael is from Avraham. This is from Ham, so this wouldn't be Nichlal in that Shiva. But again, it's unless you're going to say it's a parody, you know, which is possible. I mean, sometimes there might be a certain type of sarcastic tone in which Hashem speaks in a soothing way, but then says, "But you're going to be a nobody," kind of building up the expectation. But it's hard to say. I mean, in fact, let me just leave you with a final question to think about. This is a nevuah about Umot HaOlam. And you'll find many nevuahs. In fact, in all the Yeshayo, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, there are nevuahs Umot HaOlam. Are these nevuahs that were intended to be communicated to the Goyim? Or are these nevuahs that are intended to be communicated to the Jewish people? Now, we know in the case of Yonah is one outstanding example where explicitly there is a commandment to go to Nineveh and give them a prophecy. But many Mefarshim say that most of the nevuos against the Umos are not messages for the Umos themselves. They are messages for the Jewish people. And again, that seems to be the context here, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying over and over again that you should realize you cannot rely upon them as a mishenet, as something that you can lean upon. So it's not really Musar to the non-Jews, it is a Musar to Klal Yisrael. Okay, well, we'll stop here. Okay, thank you.